1323024 CV, Bexar County Hospital District, DBA University Health, formerly known as University Health System, versus Linda Bettis. All right, Ms. Cavaretta, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Laura Cavaretta. I have had the privilege of representing University Health System for more than 30 years. University Health System, as you know, is a governmental entity protected by the Tort Claims Act. It owns and operates hospitals and healthcare centers in San Antonio, Texas. The issue before this court is whether the plaintiff's claim falls within the limited waiver of immunity, which is set out in the Tort Claims Act. This is a plea to the jurisdiction, and so the court is reviewing the record de novo. It's important for me to point out at the beginning that the version of the Tort Claims Act that applies in this case was amended in 1985. And why is that important? Well, because there were some significant changes made to the statute and significant changes to the way the statute is interpreted. And some of the cases that are relied on by the plaintiff interpret the old version of the statute. First of all, the change that I think is most significant is the statute used to say that a claim was within the waiver if it involved some use or some condition of tangible property. And the court removed the word some. I mean, the legislature removed the word some. And the legislature also removed the requirement that the Tort Claims Act be liberally construed. So those are two very important things which were addressed in the Camel case, which I refer to in my brief, and said that because of the removal of the word some, the jurisdiction doesn't attach if the condition or use of property was merely a contributing factor to the injury. And in this case, I believe that is what we have before the court is merely a contributing factor. There is a case which is not in my brief, which is City of Dallas versus Sanchez. It is 494 Southwest 2nd, and it's 2016 Texas Supreme Court case. And in that case, the court said it is the negligent use of the property that actually has to cause the injuries. And that's an important distinction because
that's something that's being alleged in this case, actually. I know that the appellee is relying on case law subsequent to 1985, and they are alleging that the mechanism for the raising and the lowering of the bed is a safety feature, and it was not used properly. So I think they are going beyond simply saying that, you know, the bed was just a condition that caused the injury.
And Judge, I understand why you would ask that question, because what we have here is a requirement issued by the Supreme Court that the court can't just take the allegations and the evidence as written, because there have been multiple attempts by lawyers to try to plead around the Tort Claims Act to bring the claim within the Tort Claims Act. And so what this court
is non-use, misuse?
No, non-use is not actionable, not recoverable. Misuse is the negligent use of property. Use is the non-negligent use of defective property. And failure to use is not actionable. So if the property was not used at all, for example, if the hospital failed to take an EKG or do that sort of testing, that would not be actionable.
So do we have to find that the bed was not used at all?
No, ma'am.
No?
What you have to find, and I'll talk to you about how you determine if a property was mere involvement or a contributing factor, or if actually caused the harm. And I suggest that what you use is a but-for analysis that would be applied to the facts of this case. So you would ask yourself, but for the bed, would the injury have occurred in the face of the negligent act? And so the answer to that question is no, because the negligence could have occurred if the patient was on a couch or another flat surface. It's not the bed that was required to cause this injury. It was the negligence of the failure to move the patient that was the cause of the injury. If
But
you
in this case, the bed clearly was part of the treatment. I mean, these are specially designed beds for birthing. These aren't just a run-of-the-mill hospital beds, correct? This is a birthing bed. So it's part of the process, part of the treatment was used for her before and after. And I think what troubles me here is that this epidural that was given to this woman, this is a very common treatment, common occurrence with women that are in labor. And so it seems like this bed, this special birthing bed, is used in this instance. And the hospital knows that women that have been subjected to an epidural need to be repositioned. And it sounds like this bed is designed in such a way to facilitate that process is, I guess that's my question.
First of
It's
all,
nice.
I'm sorry, I don't want to interrupt.
No, the question, I guess, is, I went around about it, but the question is, isn't this bed designed in such a way to facilitate the need, perhaps, when women need to be put in different positions? That's why it raises it, lowers, and puts them in different positions because they can't do it themselves.
It is designed, you are correct, to facilitate labor so that you can put the patient in the lithotomy position so that you can put them in stirrups so that you can do a delivery. But the negligent act in question is the failure to turn the patient. It's not the use of the bed. And as I was saying, the patient was in this bed and the nurses didn't turn her, as was alleged they should have. Would the injury have occurred? And the answer is no. Why? Because it's not the bed that caused the injury. It's the failure to turn that caused the injury. And so if you look at the true nature of the allegations in the case, we're missing what we call a nexus, a causal nexus between the negligence and the actual use of the bed. There is a case out of the San Antonio Court of Appeals called Hendricks versus Greene County Hospital District, which is a 19 or 2000 case in which the court said you have to have. You can't just allege and throw out property and say, well, this was involved. You have to show that that negligent use actually caused the injury. And in 2023, November of 2023, Pecan Valley MHMR versus Doe was decided, says the same thing. And that case is at 678 Southwest 3rd 577, and it is a no petition case. Let me talk about examples of where there is a causal nexus where the bed is used. Okay. If a bed is lacking patient rails and the patient falls, yes, the bed and the lack of rails cause the patient's injury. If the patient's sitting on the edge of the bed and falls, no, the bed did not cause the injury. If there are no side rails on the bed, then that is not actionable because the courts have said that lacking a safety component is not appropriate. If you don't use the safety component, that's actionable.
Well,
And
the appellees have alleged that the mechanism for raising and the lowering of the bed is a form of a safety component.
they have alleged that, but the actual negligence that they're complaining about is the patient's positioning. And you can position the patient in the bed any way you want, regardless of whether the head of the bed is raised or lowered. With the head of the bed raised, the patient can turn on their side. With the head of the bed lowered, they can turn on their side. They can turn on their back. They can turn switch sides. So it's not incumbent on the use of the raising the lower in the head. That's a red herring that the plaintiff is putting in this to try to plead around the fact that the acts of negligence are the lack of turning. The only time that the bed is mentioned is when they say, well, the bed was misused because the head of the bed wasn't raised or lowest. That's not a misuse of the bed. What was the bed's intended purpose? It was for the patient to be on it while she's laboring. So we have an expert who says, oh, it was misused and it was not used for its intended purpose, a very conclusory statement without a basis. What is the intended purpose of the bed? Why wasn't it used for its intended purpose? So I think what we have is some smoke and mirrors here trying to distract the court from the real issue in the case. The true nature of the case is the nurses were negligent in failing to turn the patient. the fact that the head of the bed was or was not raised is not relevant to the complaint. It's just merely thrown in there to try to hook this case into the Tort Claims Act. The majority of the arguments by the plaintiff does not really address whether or not the pleadings and evidence established the bed was misused. She doesn't have a causal nexus for misusing the bed. All she says is, well, the head wasn't raised, and therefore that is a misuse of the bed. And as I said before, use is a non-negligent use of defective property, and misuse is when you negligently use property. So we have to have negligent use of the property to cause the injury. And if you look at the true nature of the case, what we are talking about is turning the patient. And if the patient hadn't been turned, would the injury have occurred regardless? And the question is yes, regardless of where the patient was. If the patient was on a bed and was turned, would the injury have occurred? No. Why? Because it's not the bed that caused the injury. It's the failure to move the patient. And you can see in looking at the petitions that the positioning of the patient is littered throughout all of the pleadings. The original petition says her injury was a positioning injury caused by protracted positioning without movement. And the patient was in a prolonged immobile sitting or supine position due to no change in position in the bed. So what they're talking about is changing the position of the patient, not the bed. The bed is extraneous as an attempt to try to pull this in, as I said. Paragraph 13 says women with epidural anesthesia should change positions. The women should change positions. It says there should be frequent repositioning of the patient and frequent maternal positioning should be made. And if you look at the allegation, you
know, that they're dependent on the hospital staff to position them in the proper way throughout this process. And the bed is part of the process. It's part of the treatment. Just like in the, I think it's the Roach case, where the court says, you know, it's difficult for us to contemplate how when a patient is placed in a bed as part of the hospital's treatment of that patient, the bed is not being used in the treatment. I realize that this is the Roach is a safety rails case, but it still involves the use of a bed in the treatment. And again, this is a special bed. This is a birthing bed, not just a run-of-the-mill hospital bed. And that's why I'm having a little difficulty separating it as clearly as you are arguing.
Well, and I think what you have to look at is it's not just that the nurses failed to reposition her. It's also alleged that they didn't tell her to move. Mm-hmm. She says they were supposed to move her or she was supposed to move her body. And that is the act of negligence.
But she couldn't. Could she?
There's no evidence that she couldn't move. Patients who have an
evidence was that she couldn't feel the need to move.
Correct.
Okay.
So if I can't feel, then I may not realize that I'm getting pins and needles and I need to move. But I can move. She moves. You see in the medical records before that they put in the epidural and then she gets vaginal exams and all sorts of additional things happen. She's moving. So again, it really boils down to the negligent act is not the bed. It's positioning and patient habitus. And the only negligence alleged by the experts is positioning of the patient. And then they say, well, and raising and lowering the head of the bed also is a way to change position, but that's not the only way. And so that's why I say that we're far outside of the Roach case, where because the side rails were not up, the patient fell off the bed. And that's a very huge distinction. I've cited the court many, many cases in which the true nature of the case was determined and the court said it's just some involvement, mere involvement. The negligent use did not cause the injury. And so I think that if the court very carefully looks at the pleadings and the evidence, and also disregards the conclusory statements that were made by the experts, which are replete in their report, and which I have addressed in my brief. As the court knows, I don't have to object to conclusory statements. They're just not evidence. And so any of that conclusory information in those documents that say it was misused or this or that, without a rational basis for it, it's conclusory and not evidence this court can consider. So I think it's important for the court to look at the true nature of the dispute and not pay attention to all of the what I consider to be smoke and mirrors and attempt to artfully plead around the Tort Claims Act. And my time is up. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Tavarada. Tavareta. I want to mispronounce your name. Ms. Maloney?
May it please the court. The intent of the Texas Tort Claims Act is to provide a limited waiver of governmental immunity, and it is not intended to foreclose claims where personal injury is caused by a condition or use of tangible personal property. Although the sheer number and breadth of Texas Tort Claims Act cases is impressive, where a patient is directly injured by property used by a government employee, which Linda was, the Texas Supreme Court and Texas Courts of Appeal have found that these cases fall squarely within the waiver of governmental immunity. And in looking at the pleading and evidence in this case, this birthing bed, as Your Honor acknowledged, is the direct cause. It is a specific birthing bed model LD, labor and delivery 403, and it was the direct cause of Linda's nerve injury. It was literally the mechanism of the injury. And importantly, there is no evidence that anything but the bed caused Linda's injury. I cite to the Wise v. Britton case, which is a Fort Worth case, 2008, where the court said, looking at all of the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, we find that the use of this medication concurred with her heart condition to cause her death. And the court specifically said, combing through the voluminous record of testimony offered, we find no evidence that no such causal connection existed, concluding that the appellants failed to carry their burden to conclusively establish lack of causation. And so here, there is affirmative evidence that we have provided showing that the bed was the direct and proximate cause of the injury. The legal evidence, the only legal evidence of causation in this case, is actually uncontroverted. And the appellant has still to state what the actual object, item, property, what hurt Linda? She wasn't in a vacuum. What is the actual item that caused her injury?
She clearly argued it was the failure to reposition her. It didn't matter whether she was on the bed. It wouldn't have mattered if she was on the floor or on a couch or some other item. If she had not been repositioned in that other setting, she still would have been injured.
Two points on that, Your Honor. One, this is not a patient who ever would have been on a floor,
right,
on a couch. Those circumstances would never have existed. So I agree, appellant may be correct under certain circumstances that are not the facts of this case. But limited to the facts of this case, that argument is not supported by the record. I do have to correct one point. If you look at the clerk's record supplemental, page 71, which is the affidavit of Ms. Perez, she specifically states, I told the nurse I could not feel anything and could not move. She also said, I continue to not feel labor pain and continue to not be able to move. I think that's an important clarification to make, because there is ample evidence that this is a patient who could not move.
Let me ask you a question about cases involving bed sores, or the ubiquitous ulcers that are caused by failing to reposition or move patients. Obviously, I have not read all of the cases that you all cited, because you cited a bunch, but I know the Spindletop case involved bed sores. But in that case, I think they found that there were no allegations attacking the condition of the bed or the equipment. that was defective or lacked an integral safety. Are there any cases involving this type of injury, bed sores or ulcers, where waiver has been found?
I am not aware of a specific case involving a bed sore per se, although there are ample bed cases. The issue in Spindletop was a non-use case, a non-use issue. And I think that's really important here because there was no allegation that the mattress itself had something wrong with it or that the mattress wasn't used in the way that it needed to be used to be safe for the patient. The problem was this is a patient who already had an ulcer, who came in with an ulcer, and then they didn't use pressure relieving devices that are not part of the bed, but additional items to make it safe for the patient. And so that's distinguishable from the present case, you know, in a couple of really important ways. One, this is a misuse of the bed situation, wherein the misuse of this bed, which was the correct bed for Linda to be in, caused her injury. And then also in the alternative, and in addition, the condition of the bed is being attacked because it had safety devices. It had controls that allowed this big, heavy technological bed to be moved, and they weren't used. And that's exactly analogous to the Roach and the Hampton cases. And
is the purpose of those mechanisms to move the bed, to raise and lower the head or whatever, is the purpose of those merely for comfort, or do they serve another purpose beyond that, such as in this case, repositioning a woman that has had an epidural and needs assistance in moving?
It's exactly the latter, Your Honor. The report of Dr. Guarino is specifically elucidates on that specific subject. And he talks about how these controls are safety devices because they, if used, will prevent the exact injury that was suffered. An important point to bring up that is in the record as well is that Linda was obese, which put her also at greater risk of nerve injury, which additionally goes to foreseeability, but it also can make it more difficult for nurses to reposition patients on the bed, thus necessitating even more reliance on the controls that would otherwise be required. And that's specifically referenced at the clerk's supplemental record at 83 and also at 68. And so those are different factors that make these controls safety devices, safety aspects of the bed. When you put a patient who is essentially paralyzed from the waist down, you risk that they're going to suffer a nerve injury. This is a known risk. And that is why you have to move the patient on the bed. This patient could not control her bowel and bladder, and her position on the bed did remain unchanged for more than 24 hours before the C-section was performed. I'd like to talk very, very briefly about the fact that once property, and this goes specifically to misuse, not condition, but the use of the bed, when property is brought into action, it must continue to be used properly. And there is a continuing duty to use this. And this is far from exhaustive, but the Hardy case out of Houston 14th basically says you put an alarm on a patient. If you fail to respond to it, that isn't a failure to act. That is a misuse of the alarm. The Hampton and Roach cases are out of Houston and Texarkana respectively, but they say the same thing. The leaving the patient, putting the patient on the bed is bringing the bed into use. And then the walking away is not a failure to act. The bed is in use. Harris and Rhodes are both sponge cases where sponges were properly put into use, but then left in the patients. It is the leaving and the departing. The Moses case out of Austin is similar. You give a flu shot to a patient, who's known to faint and you walk away, that's not failing to act. That is misusing the exam table because you have this knowledge. There is a recent case, the Texas Tech University Health Science Center case v. Oaxaca, which is not in our briefing because it came out after our response was due, and that's 2023 Westlaw 4118580. And in this case, it's really informative on this point of leaving. A patient was in the hospital. A catheter was placed so that he could get dialysis. He finished getting dialysis. The catheter was no longer in use, but the hospital didn't take it out. And they actually even discharged him from the hospital, and he had an infection in the catheter. And the court argued, the hospital argued, that's non-use. That's non-use of the catheter. And the Court of Appeals rejected that, and they relied on McKenzie. And McKenzie is the most recent Texas Supreme Court case on medical Texas Tort Claims Act cases. And it said, the TTCA does not narrow the definition of use to encompass only the administration. And that's consistent with the long line of cases in the context of placement and then disregard. And so as to use, the bringing of the bed into action, putting Linda on it, not letting her, putting her on strict bed rest, not letting her get out of it, that was bringing the bed into use, and it remained in use until after her injury had been incurred. The bed was in use the entire time. And so whether we're going to argue the position of the patient on the bed versus the position of the bed in relation to the patient, as far as misuse goes, it's somewhat irrelevant. As to condition of the bed, I agree that it's relevant. But here, the Texas Supreme Court in 2023 in the Rattray v. City of Brownsville case gave what I think is an interesting or a helpful instruction on evaluating use and non-use. And it's in the motor-driven equipment part of the statute, so it's not specifically relevant, but it does talk about use, and it tells us we should not aim to be unduly restrictive or to engage in sophistry in our understanding of use. So an argument that the true nature of the claim is the patient's positioning on the bed and not the positioning of the bed in relation to the patient, and that makes all the difference in terms of whether the bed was used, is the sophistry, the intellectual laboriousness that I think that the Supreme Court is instructing us to stay away from. Because this case is really quite simple. A patient was put in the bed as part of her treatment. The bed was misused. There's a policy that shows us the patient needs to be repositioned if an epidural is given. I'd like to briefly just give this the analogy of the heating pad, which is if a patient is put on a heating pad, that might be a perfectly fine action. I think everyone would agree the heating pad is brought into use. But if you leave the patient on the heating pad for an indefinite amount of time and cause burns, that continued use becomes a misuse. And that's exactly what happened here. Linda had to be on that bed. There was
in the heating pad case, then it's being used beyond what its intended use is. It's not intended to be used for an extended period of time.
And here the bed is intended to be used in a way that is safe for the patient, which means to adjust the patient on the bed and the positioning of the bed so that the patient doesn't get a nerve injury, because that is the number one risk of leaving a patient lying in a bed without coming back who has an epidural and under these specific factors. And so That is exactly the point. That is, that makes the bed not being used for its intended purpose, because the intended purpose of a birthing bed is to provide a safe surface for this patient to labor on. And the Hampton Court points this out as well. A failure to use property properly does not equate to mere non-use.
Let me ask you a question. So going back to the safety argument, because I think that's critical in this case, you have, of course, argued and referred to your experts' opinions regarding why these mechanisms that are in place to raise and lower the bed, why those are safety features. But appellant has argued that there's no authority to support this contention that controls which raise or lower the bed have anything to do with safety. So what is there some authority that can help guide us in this area to say that these controls are for safety, that that's their purpose?
Sure. The specific testimony in Dr. Guarino's report is that these are safety components. He doesn't just say it out of nowhere. He says these are safety components because their proper use in adjusting the bed prevents the exact injury suffered. And so if you aren't concerned about a patient having an epidural and needing to be moved, then they can labor on the floor. They can labor on the yoga ball. They can labor on the couch. But if they're going to be in this bed, their position on the bed is going to need to be adjusted. Otherwise, the weight of the body is going to cause this exact injury. And that is why they are critical components of the bed that cannot be divorced from the bed.
But I think what appellant argues, there's no authority to in this area. I guess there's no case law, perhaps, that is on point where a feature such as this has been found by a court to say this is, you know, a safety mechanism.
I would say that the Roach and the Hampton cases they both refer to side rails, but those are also just parts of the bed. So the argument that appellant might take on the side of Roach or Hampton would be, well, those aren't safety devices because they're used for other purposes. They're also used so patients can pull themselves up in bed. Those are also used because you can tie restraints to them. Those are also used because you can attach a meal tray to them. There's no special language or something that makes something a safety device. It's not called a safety rail, for example. It's literally a side rail. These are literally controls that provide a safety mechanism for this particular birthing bed. I think that can be true for that entire line of cases about the safety part, the safety component of the bed. Like if you look at the San Antonio case, Garcia, that was a case in which an oxygen mask was put on a patient and then the oxygen was discontinued. And the San Antonio Court of Appeals said the oxygen is an essential component of a single system. And if you remove that, then it's not safe anymore. And so I wouldn't say oxygen in a vacuum is a safety device. I wouldn't say a control in a vacuum is a safety device. But here in this context, the controls, as Dr. Guarino testifies to, are absolutely a safety device. And touching on the pleadings, if I can move on, specific to the use of the defective hospital bed, the plaintiff has pled that in order to relieve the forces exerted by the hospital bed onto the plaintiff's nerves, the defendant was required to utilize the basic safety equipment with which the bed was accompanied to raise and lower the head of the bed in order to change the allocation of pressure. Plaintiff is not required to prove her case on the merits but only to plead sufficient facts to affirmatively demonstrate the trial court's subject matter jurisdiction. And those facts and the evidence that's been submitted affirmatively demonstrate the trial court's jurisdiction. The standard of review that the trial court had to use and that now is applied on appeal and in this de novo review is to take plaintiff's pleadings as true and construe them liberally to give effect to the pleader's intent, and also consider the evidence submitted, indulging every reasonable inference and resolving all doubts in favor of the non-movement. And in the Rattray v. City of Brownsville case, I believe it was Justice Hinojosa in her dissent, writes, you know, what the majority is doing here is, I fear, indulging every, you know, reasonable inference in favor of the city and resolving all doubts in favor of the city and not doing the appropriate standard of review. And that at the Supreme Court level was determined to be true because this is a very specific standard of review. And I am out of time. Thank you, Your Honors.
So, thank you very much. We appreciate that. You may proceed, Ms. Caporetta.
Yes, Your Honor. I would like to start out by talking about the issue of whether or not this is a safety component and whether or not the birthing bed is critical to the care of the patient. Dr. Guino makes those statements, but he does not provide any basis for them. As you said, a safety component is something that keeps you safe. Raising and lowering the head of the bed is often for the patient's comfort. And there's nothing in the record to show that whether you're sitting up or lying down, you're still going to be in a position to put pressure on your sciatic nerve. So what you have to do is have the patient roll over on their side. So this up and down critical safety component argument, it fails. And then going to the spindle top case, because I think you were right, the spindle top case is very much important to the resolution of this case. And let me read to you what the on the very first page of spindle top, it says specifically, we are asked whether a claim that bed sores were caused by a bed or other property involves an injury caused by a use of tangible personal property. That's the same issue here. And the court said no, because
the court said no, because they hadn't really made the allegations like are being made here. But I think that's a bit of a distinction.
I think the court said no, because the patient's allegations were they should have turned the patient. The patient said this patient should have been moved. The patient should have been monitored. And so I think when you look at the crux of the case and go back to the true nature of the dispute, you get to the point where what is the negligent act? And the negligent act is not putting her in this bed. The negligent act is not turning her on the bed. The safety device issue, the failure to use a safety device, first of all, I don't think there's anything aside from a conclusory statement that it is a safety device. But second of all, the Kerrville, Bishop, and Cowan cases, all Texas Supreme Court cases that I cite on page 25 of my brief, say the failure to use a safety device is not actionable. It's the failure to provide a safety device that is actionable. So if it was a safety device, it wasn't used, and that is not actionable under the Kerrville, Bishop, and Cowan cases. And then going to the Oaxaca case, the real issue in that case was not whether or not they should have taken the catheter out. The court said that there was a viable claim under the Tort Claims Act because the allegations were, yes, one was that the catheter should have been removed, but the reason the court kept this case and said there's jurisdiction because the true nature of the case was you put the wrong catheter in. You shouldn't have put a temporary catheter in a patient if you plan on keeping it for longer than a certain period of time. So it's not about you should have taken it out. It's that the decision to put the wrong catheter in and then actually putting the wrong size catheter in was a condition or use of tangible property, and it was a negligent act. And I think that those distinctions are pretty clear and important for the court to recognize. Just calling it a safety device doesn't make it one. And if you look at the affidavits and expert reports, where Dr. Guarino says the hospital bed is a critical part of her treatment, tell me how, tell me why, tell me what the basis is for that statement. Shin says the bed was misused, but she doesn't explain how the bed was misused. I mean, the bed was used for a patient to lie on it. If you don't raise and lower the head of the bed, is that misusing the bed? Or is that failure to use a component? What is the purpose of a bed? It's for somebody to lie on. She was lying on it. Did the bed cause her injury? No, the bed did not cause her injury. Her injury was caused because she was not turned. And she, as her physician said in the medical records, continued positioning in the same place caused her to get this nerve injury. And so I think that trying to use this bed as the tangible property is outside the scope of the Tort Claims Act. And if the court just looks at the true nature of the dispute and looks at the expert reports and the pleadings, you will see all through, it's about turning the patient. It's about moving the patient. It's about the patient's position. It's not about the bed.
Thank you very much. Case will be under submission.